Roy Bourgeois was raised in a small town in Louisiana. After a stint in Vietnam, he, quote, decided to put the life of a warrior behind him and became a Catholic priest. He went to Bolivia and worked for the poor for 5 years and became increasingly aware of the role of the U.S. military in the region. Since then, Father Bourgeois has made it his life's work to shut down the School of the Americas in Georgia, where death squad leaders and torturers are trained by the U.S. military to do their so-called dirty work in Central and South America. Father Bourgeois spoke in Portland in the fall of 2008. We bring you now a portion of that speech.
It took me quite some time to get on that road to peace and justice. When I grew up in this small town in Louisiana, when we gathered into our little church there, we didn't really critique U.S. foreign policy. We didn't question our leaders. We didn't talk about peace and justice. We did not mention that sin of racism and sexism that was so alive in our community and our church. I went to the State University. I got a degree in geology and worked hard at that degree. When I left college, it was during the days of Vietnam. It was very easy for me to join the military. I was taught to be patriotic. I spent the next 4 years in the military. In a way, it was my ticket out of Louisiana. 2 years aboard ship as a young naval officer, went to a NATO station in Europe. And then when our leaders were saying we had to go off to Vietnam, I bought into that, as many of us did. They said we were going to be the liberators. Our cause was noble. The same language that they used to justify the war in Iraq. Isaiah, the prophet of the Hebrew scriptures, said it so well. He said, they will take evil and call it good. They will take the lie and give it to you as truth. And this is what they did in Vietnam. And this is what our leaders did about Iraq. And we bought into that evil and those lies. But fortunately today, we can see the lie about what's going on in Iraq. We know it was a terrible mistake. And so many died for that mistake. It was in Vietnam that became a turning point in my life. The violence, the suffering there, losing friends, wounded there. I don't know what else to say other than I was forced into the arms of God. Death was close. I've come to the conclusion, not overnight, but through that experience in Vietnam that has just simply grown over the years, that we are not made for war. Read about the tens of thousands struggling with PTSD, the suicides. We are not made for war. Our God, a loving God, a creator, who has given us life that's sacred and precious, did not make us for war. And I and many have come to the conclusion in our journey of faith, something very important and very clear. God does not bless war. God does not bless killing. God does not bless violence. God does not bless discrimination in its many forms. It saddens me to see the silence of our spiritual leaders, our church leaders. As a Catholic priest in my travels throughout the country, I'm often asked, why are our church leaders, our spiritual leaders, so silent on this war in Iraq? I do believe that many of our church leaders have become corporate executives. Our shepherds have become government sheep. And I have no doubt at all, if we had in the Catholic Church women priests and women bishops, that silence would be broken. I know that. But we have learned something very important. Peace will not come from the top down. No. It will come from the bottom up. We will be the peacemakers. Not the corporate executives, not the politicians, not the spiritual leaders who have grown silent. No. It is our responsibility. If there will be peace in our world, in our country, it must come from us. I came back from Vietnam. My year was up, and I must say I was so grateful to be alive. Back in Louisiana with my family, close-knit family, my siblings, my friends. And I came back different from that person I was when I went there. It was in Vietnam that I lost my hope. This joy that was so much a part of my life just fell apart. And that's what war does. It kills hope, destroys joy. And I wanted to try to rediscover that. I was led to the Maranoa community by a chaplain in Vietnam when I realized that peace was the only way that I'm going to recapture my hope. And he recommended the Maranoa community, working in 25 countries around the world, serving the poor. He said they were healers. They were peacemakers. And I entered the community. And I must say, it began for me a whole new world. 6 years in the seminary, a lot of reflection, a lot of studies. And then I was ordained a Catholic priest and now assigned to our work in Bolivia. Bolivia's pretty much very much in the news today. It's a very poor country. Most of the people of Bolivia throughout the developing world live on the edge. They struggle for survival. They're in the shacks without running water, without electricity. I went into La Paz, a slum there, and I began to live with the people, the poor. And they became my teachers. And that's the way it works. If we will only dare to put our feet with them, the poor, the oppressed of our world, the victims of violence, they will teach us so much. Bolivia was living under a brutal dictator, General Banzer, who came into power through a violent coup. And it angered me to see my country there, the United States, giving guns and training to the men with the guns, the bullies, the thugs. They ran the country. And the large corporations back then and today, they're coming into those countries like Bolivia, where there are huge profits to be made from the cheap labor and those vast natural resources. They see us as el imperio, the empire, the new conquistadors who are there to enrich ourselves, to live really, to profit from the blood and sweat of the poor. It's not complicated. People who live under such conditions day in and day out, year in, year out, begin to organize. They say, basta, enough. I must say I was very humbled there as a Catholic priest to be connected to the comunidades de base, the faith communities, the poorest of the poor, coming together in their small groups to read and reflect on the scriptures, where they come to discover this loving God, a creator, who has given to their country and every country more than enough resources for everyone to live comfortably and in peace. And they know that this is not God's divine will, that they should live under these conditions. They know that the reasons are oppression, exploitation. Countries like the United States and others who come to exploit them. And they are feeling empowered by their God today, a liberating God. And out of this comes liberation theology. I'm sad to say that a lot of people, including leaders in the churches, are threatened by the word liberation. They prefer model of church that's very patriarchal, hierarchical, top-down. But liberation theology, that model is circular, where all are welcomed into that circle as brothers and sisters, as equals, as hermanos y hermanas. And what's going on, they are simply being empowered by their faith, by their knowledge. And they're saying, basta. And the factories, the tin mines, the universities, and throughout the small base communities, they're coming together to change their world. A world where they know there can be peace and justice and food for the table and a living wage for them and adequate housing. And this is at the very core of their struggle. When the poor become organized and speak out against the oppressor, there are serious implications. It's dangerous. Many are forced to flee the country with death threats, many killed. The jails in Bolivia filled up with university students, factory workers, tin miners, and their spiritual leaders, priests and others. And I and others were able, from the barrio, from the slum there, along with the Jesuit, a couple of Dominicans, we were able to get a pass to visit the political prisoners and documented many cases of torture. And it was after going to Washington with our findings to bring to congressional leaders, when I returned to Bolivia, I was arrested in my fifth year and forced out of the country. I came home very sad. I did not want to leave the people there and our work. I tried to go back, could not get a visa. My attention turned to El Salvador, a country far worse than the one I came from. Archbishop Oscar Romero had just been assassinated in his country, gunned down in his church for his defense of the poor. Four churchwomen from our country who went there at the invitation of Bishop Romero to work with the poor were raped and killed by the Salvadoran military. Two of them good friends of the Marino sisters, Maura Clark and Ida Ford. When that happened, it brought many of us to El Salvador. And once again, when we were there, we found our country, the United States, deeply involved, giving guns and training to those doing the killing. I must say, I've never seen anything like El Salvador. I was more frightened there than in Vietnam and Bolivia. It was the slaughter of the innocents. So many disappeared. The knock would come on the door at night. There's a list. They're campesinos, the landless farmers, being paid $1 a day to pick those coffee beans. University students and others, labor leaders, healthcare workers, leaders in the base communities. They were seen as el enemigo, the enemy. They threatened that system of power and wealth. And they were brutal. They were brutal. And our country knew exactly what was going on there. I and others came back from El Salvador, and we could not shut up. We had to speak out. And when 525 soldiers from Fort Benning arrived, from El Salvador, arrived at Fort Benning in Georgia to start training now on U.S. soil in combat, we said, no, not in our name. We went there to organize, rented this little house, called it Casa Romero, gave talks in colleges and churches nearby. And then three of us said, let's take the message to the Salvadoran soldiers now. It's the time. Linda Ventimiglia, who was in the Army Reserves, who had trained at Benning. Larry Rosebaum, an oblate priest who had just come back from his work in Brazil, and I. We went down to Ranger Joe's, an Army surplus place. We bought ourselves some Army uniforms. A few nights later, we entered Fort Benning at 9, 10 o'clock at night. We had with us this very powerful boombox. And in it was the last sermon of Bishop Romero that he gave in the cathedral the day before he was assassinated, where he made a special plea to the men in the military. Lay down your arms, he said. Stop the killing. Disobey your superior officers telling you to kill your brothers and sisters, your fellow campesinos. And obey a higher law, that law of God that says, thou shalt not kill. Bishop Romero, I must say, we can speak for hours about this prophet, this martyr. He was so much like us. When he was made bishop, the wealthy of the country said, he's going to be our friend. He won't, shake up things. He was seen as aloof, a bookworm. He always gave people spiritual lollipops in his sermons. I don't know where we picked that up. I don't know if it's in the seminary or clergy, bishops. We like to give out these little spiritual lollipops. We don't want to upset people. The message is always otherworldly. But something happened to Bishop Romero. He had this big heart filled with compassion. And he was able to hear the cry of his people. And he felt their suffering deeply. And something happened along the way. He said, I'm a bishop. I have a voice. I have power. My people are powerless, he said, are voiceless. If I don't speak for them, who will? Wow. Wow. If every spiritual leader, if every bishop could feel this way. And he got the death threats. But he said, I cannot leave. I must stay the course. And right, it was the next day after his special plea to the military, he was assassinated. And he inspired us that night, gave us the courage that we lacked to do what we were going to do. We entered Fort Benning, this high security area, got saluted. It was a shaky salute. We were very scared. Went near the barracks where the soldiers were housed. And we scaled this tall pine tree. And when the last lights went out, we said, Bishop Romero, this is for you, brother. And his voice just boomed into the barracks. And they were pretty upset with us. We saw this. It was like poking the beehive. We saw this as a sacred moment. They didn't quite see it that way. They came out with their M16s, the dogs, the lights, spotted us in the tree, ordered us down, or they would shoot us down. We came down, it was time, but left the boombox up there with the Bishop Romero's message repeated, lay down your weapon, stop the killing. They worked us over, handcuffed us, brought in the FBI, brought us to jail, and then to trial. And it was at that trial that we tried as best we could to put our country's foreign policy on trial that day. But the old judge, Maximum Bob, didn't want to hear it. He sent us to prison for a year and a half. And in the courtroom, there were our parents and brothers and sisters and friends. And we wanted so badly, I know with my family, to explain why I did what I did. Because they were scared. They didn't understand this. And all we could say was that somehow, and that's, I think, our experience. We have experiences. There are people in our lives who touch us so deeply that we cannot continue on our journey in silence. They change us. They enable us to speak clearly and boldly in humble ways. And that's all, in a way, we try to say. At their university in San Salvador, they were educating the world about what was going on in El Salvador. They referred to the issue as idolatry, the worship of the false gods of wealth and power. And they began to name those institutions and individuals who were worshiping the false gods. And they, like Bishop Romero, got the death threats. And they also said, where are we to go? We cannot abandon our people. November the 16th, 1989, the military, after midnight, moved into their campus, dragged these six Jesuits out of their rooms. With them, a young mother, their co-worker, Elba, along with her teenage daughter, Selena. And they were all shot at close range. They were massacred. This made the front pages of our newspapers. It angered many of our members of Congress, many of them who knew some of the Jesuits, educated at some of their high schools and universities. All of a sudden, they become closer to the issue. They send a congressional task force to El Salvador to investigate. They come back reporting that those who did the killing, those responsible for the massacre, were trained in the United States at the U.S. Army School of the Americas at Fort Benning, Georgia. At the time, I'm now working with my Marino community in Minnesota, doing a lot of work on El Salvador, peace and justice work. And it was time now to go to Georgia, return to Fort Benning, to investigate the School of the Americas. And I went there with the blessing and the support of my community. And right outside of the main gate, found this little apartment. A soldier had just been transferred. I moved in, rent $175 a month. This became our SOA watch. Back then, we didn't have a movement. Friends came into town to join me there. Kathy Kelly, and if you know Kathy, we had dinner this evening. She's now in Portland giving some talks. Kathy Kelly, longtime peace activist from Chicago. Charlie Litke came in from California, a Vietnam veteran, recipient of the Congressional Medal of Honor, a Jesuit, two Dominicans, three Salvadorans. We had 3 days of reflection. What are we going to do, we said. That basic question that we must ask ourselves over and over again. What am I to do? What are we to do about this issue? So many are being killed, so many suffering. We knew that we could not be silent. What will we do? And at this nice Mexican restaurant, we decided on a fast. I've learned something. Never plan a fast at a restaurant. Always sounds like a great idea. And it was. We began a water-only fast, camping out at the main gate. And Mahatma Gandhi was right, and Cesar Chavez and others who fasted and taught us something very, very important. If we go into a fast trying to expose an evil, an injustice, trying to express our solidarity with others, with love in our hearts, you can't go wrong, they said. And that was our experience. So much began to happen. Our hearts were moved in the hearts of others. Every day we would congregate from 5 to 6 at the main gate where people would bring their music, their poetry, their experiences, where we're all uplifted. 2-3 o'clock in the morning, soldiers would come, fearful to be with us during the day. They would come and wanted to talk with us about why we were on this hunger strike. What did we believe in so deeply was their question. Our fast ended after 35 days. The body was weak, but the spirit was strong. We got healthy again, and we had to now do research. We had to find out more about the School of the Americas, which was hiding behind this wall of secrecy. We learned early on that over 50,000 soldiers from 18 countries in Latin America were being trained here. Today, most of them coming in from Colombia. They came here to learn commando tactics, counterinsurgency techniques. Who were the insurgents, we asked, and learned that they were the landless farmers, university students, tin miners, factory workers, labor leaders, especially in Colombia. They were the targets of those who were being trained at this school, known in Latin America as Una Escuela de Asesinos, a school of assassins. And then we learned, which hit the front pages of newspapers like the Washington Post and the New York Times, that there were manuals in this school that advocated torture that got the school in big trouble. And then when the United Nations Truth Commission report on El Salvador was made public and revealed that those who killed Bishop Romero trained here, those who raped and killed the church women graduates, the 27 who killed the Jesuits and the two women, 19 of them graduates. And the list went on and on. And we said, it's time now to educate ourselves more about this issue, educate the public, the media, and members of Congress. There was so much ignorance on this issue. We began a website, had to spread the word. We started traveling, taking our research into churches, colleges, peace groups, talking about that school of assassins down in Georgia. And we said, every November around the time of the massacre of the Jesuits and the two women, let us gather at the main gate of Fort Benning, put our feet there to keep alive the memory of the victims and call for the closing of this school, all paid for with our tax money, all done in our name. That first year, we had just a handful of us. The next year, a couple hundred came. We continued to travel. We decided to make our first documentary, 19 minutes long, called it School of Assassins. Got Susan Sarandon to narrate it for us. Got us an Oscar nomination. Sold over 18,000 copies. All of a sudden, more and more people are hearing about that school down in Georgia. And then a few thousand show up. I'm happy to report that this last November, some 20,000 came. And as we looked out at the sea of people, over half were college and high school students, which brings a lot of joy to us to see the youth of our country, the students, who have really become somewhat of the backbone of our movement. Also gathered there were a lot of sisters, the nuns, who joined our movement in the very beginning, who passed the very first resolution way back in 1993, calling for the closing of the school. The Leadership Conference of Religious Women, with 78,000 nuns as members, and look out. Thousands of letters were arriving in those offices in Washington. Right after the nuns, the Presbyterian Church came out, passed overwhelmingly with their church another resolution similar, calling for the closing of the school. The Lutherans, the Methodists, NAACP, United Church of Christ, all the peace churches. And I'm also happy to say that over half of our Catholic bishops signed on to a resolution calling for its closing. The other half, they're still studying it. When we gather, we had a lot of veterans there this last November who have come into our movement, Vietnam vets, Iraq vets, a lot of senior citizens, the Grandmothers for Peace always there with us, a lot of parents with their children. We're there speaking with one voice. We're there in the name of peace. It's a big celebration of hope. That weekend, we have many, many different workshops at the convention center. A lot of billboards now welcoming us. Welcome, peacemakers. In the early days, those signs said, they referred to us as a small group of outside agitators. Leave town. But then when our numbers got up to about 5,000, I got a call from the Visitors Bureau. When is your next convention going to be? All of a sudden, we're going to have a convention. And I didn't realize that we were pumping a lot of money into that community, filling up the hotels and restaurants. And now, I must say, really, we've got some critics, but they welcome the protesters today. And many are sincere, because I know I've lived there for years now, and they talk about their good experiences with those who come into town every weekend, every November. And we're going to, in Sunday, it's more solemn. We have our solemn funeral procession. How many have been down with us in November? You know that experience. We're marching, 9 abreast. Thousands are holding the crosses, some the Star of David, photographs of the victims. The names are called out in the ages, many of them children. At the end of each name called in unison, thousands will say, "Presente," this person is present. And it's here that we touch on the sacred. Many weep. We get to this fence. There's these huge two fences now, chain link fences topped with barbed wire. These signs that say, "No trespassing." I won't tell you where I got this sign here. We get to the fence and we put our crosses and religious symbols on that fence. You can't see the other side. We turn it into something very sacred. Early on, it became our tradition when we gathered there to go on to Fort Benning. Some felt compelled to do that, to take the message to the headquarters. When we do that, when we cross that line, they say, "We're trespassing." We're arrested and brought to trial and then sent to prison. I'm happy to report that over 250 of our people now have gone off to prison. And Oregon is well represented. And we call our prisoners, they're called our prisoners of conscience. And they have so energized our movement.